Welcome to episode number 22 of the Circles Off podcast. I'm Rob Pizzola, joined by Johnny from Betstamp. And this week, we welcome in another guest, a good friend of mine. You can follow him on Twitter at Suma, S-U-U-M-A 810, 810. Also trackable on Betstamp at Fabian Sommer, his full name. Local bookies know him as the Dusseldorf Destroyer for all the damage he does in the NFL to the local bookies over there. But seriously, four seasons of publicly documented great record keeping where he's returned at least a 7.5% ROI in the NFL, which is outstanding. Dude that's very passionate about closing line value, and a co-host of mine on the Matchbook podcast, which is renewed again this year. Fabian Sommer, welcome to Circles Off. How are things?
What an intro, Rob. Thanks, guys, for having me. After Rufus and Spanky the past couple of weeks, I think I have some big shoes to fill. But it's an honor to be here, and I feel very welcomed by you.
I was debating whether to go with Dusseldorf Destroyer or Dortmund Destroyer, but I wanted to go like not with a huge major city, so I went with Dusseldorf instead, but I completely butchered it, and now I feel like I made a mistake. But how are things in Germany, Suma? How's the summer been?
Very shitty in terms of weather. I think like since the start of July, we had like 5 or 6 real summer days. Today it was 12 degrees or 10 degrees, something like that. Very cold for an August day. That's driving me nuts. Basically, you cannot even go outside after work. So that's very shitty, but everything else is fine. COVID has cooled down here over here. Vaccination rate is around 60%. So I think it could be worse.
Well, bad weather is just more time to focus on prepping for NFL season, right?
Exactly.
So, Suma, we got the season right around the corner. We know everybody's fired up for that. Unlike, like you mentioned, our previous two guests, I haven't heard you on too many podcasts. I know I've heard you before, but we wanted to give you a chance here to kind of tell your story, you know, how you came up and why you're so passionate about football and betting.
Betting started very early when I was like 17 or 18 years old. I think it was around 2008, 2009. And in Germany, we always had betting available to us. There were also some online bookies like Bwin, Bet365 that had European licenses and that were able to basically run their business for German customers. So there was never an issue with legalization. And when I became 18, I was playing poker for a couple of years, not with any stakes, just with some friends at PokerStars. We had that Chris Moneymaker poker boom, where also German broadcasts and TV channels were broadcasting all those World Series of Poker, European Poker Tour. And so I was always hooked with gambling in general. And then when I got 18, pretty much on the first or second day, I signed up at one of those online bookies and I was depositing like $100 and I was pretty much firing some 10, 20 bucks live bets on women, Greek, volleyball, race to 10 and whatever, just getting down some stuff. And that's pretty much how I got to betting in general. And then I think around 2009, it was the Super Bowl Cardinals against Steelers. I think that was in 2009. That was my first real Super Bowl that I watched. And I found that sport very interesting. And that upcoming season, I started watching more and more. I also became a Jets fan, so to speak, because in Germany, we had that sitcom King of Queens. And right. Dag Heffernan is a big time New York sports fan and Jets fan. And somehow I just took that over from that sitcom. And I just started watching more Jets games in general. Those were the Rex Ryan years where the Jets were very good, with a great defense. And suddenly in 2009, I got completely hooked with football in general. And I started watching it every Sunday. We had a German broadcast that was streaming ESPN. So you were able to watch NFL pretty much every Sunday. And at some point, I was also throwing money on some NFL games. And that was probably in the early 2010, somewhere around that range. And that's pretty much how I got started in betting and betting on the NFL.
It's an interesting story. I think it mirrors mine in a lot of ways because I also got started in gambling because of the Chris Moneymaker poker boom, and that lasted for about a year for me. And then I started betting like a degenerate. I don't think I was going to like Greek women's volleyball or anything like that. I don't think I ever went that deep, but I was betting on like the closing digit of the Nikkei index and like stock markets and stuff, real degenerate stuff.
That's arguably worse, actually.
Oh, it's so much worse because I was so bad that, and I hate to turn this about me, but like I was one of those guys that would pull data of like the last, 300 days of closing prices and thought I actually had an edge because the last digit was, a 9, 30% of the time. Anyways, I don't really want to get into that phase of my life. I'm past that. But what I wanted to ask you, Suma, is you very quickly, I guess, went from someone who's betting small stakes. I don't want to necessarily call you a degenerate, but just trying to throw your money down recreationally to eventually someone who's doing this seriously and someone who's actually got a bona fide edge in a sport where, frankly, if you ask 99% of the bookmakers on the planet, they would book anyone in NFL at any time, even higher than 99%. How does someone go from, making that leap to from that recreational bettor to someone who's taking this very seriously and eventually doing it for a living?
So I think there was a lot of luck involved and a lot of positive variance and a lot of randomness because in the early 2010s, I was posting in a private forum where I just started when I had free time. I was posting my picks, my 50 euros picks at the time. And I was just starting to write about my thoughts on the games. Just like that, because I always loved writing, and just to spend some time, I started posting my thoughts in a forum. And in 2014, I started posting all my picks and analysis publicly in the Covers NFL forum. And that season was my best season against the spread. I was betting like peanuts at the time, but I hit like 62% against the spread on like 140 picks or something. And suddenly my weekly threads had like 25,000 visits or something. And that time I realized, oh, that seems to be a big market and people want to read content. They want to get picks, but they also want to read content because I thought at the time there's a niche market for people who post their picks online, but also give some sound analysis or at least explain their thought process. Because 95% of the time, people just give out their picks or tell you something about terrible trends that don't even matter. And at that season, I had my best record, and I don't know whether I would have continued to post my picks and do all that analysis on NFL if I had a losing season that time. Maybe I would have thought, oh, okay, that's a waste of time. But because I had that great season, I thought maybe there's a chance for more. Keep doing it. And I kept doing it. And at the time, I was throwing all my money on stupid soccer parlay cards. And I just started to work with a small bankroll entirely on the NFL. And that was doing pretty well, and that's basically how it went going.
For all the listeners who are listening, and for full transparency purposes, Suma does run a subscription service where he sells his plays. So that's something we're going to get into a little bit later. But Suma, what I'm interested in is you have that amazing season in 2014 on the Covers forum. Did you realize you had an edge at that time, or did you start to think to yourself, I can monetize by selling these plays without knowing that you had an edge, or maybe it was just a combo of both?
It was more the latter. I would say I was very stupid at the time and I didn't really know anything. I just thought that I'm just good at this without really having the thought process about quantifying that edge. I didn't know anything about closing line value. I just thought that maybe I'm just a good handicapper and I understand what I'm doing, and maybe I can hit 60% again in 2015. So that was my thought process. I was really stupid at the time. But I also, in that year, already saw the chance that at some point you could maybe monetize it, because I was building a following and I saw very many people going tout, who just had one good season, or who were just spraying their picks all over the covers NFL forum. And once they had a good streak, they were saying, right now I'm starting to sell all my picks and not posting them anymore. But at the time I found out that there might be a pretty good market for people who have a solid track record of picks, but also provide content where other people find value in. And that was always my goal in mind, that I could someday monetize it.
How did the 2015 season go, if you remember?
Something like 70-60, okay. Somewhere around 54%, something like that.
So you would have made money that season as well, I guess, and every other season since, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Interesting. You pointed out the closing line value comment there, which is I always find interesting. Again, I don't mean to harp on this myself, but just a personal story. I mean, my closest group of friends know what I do for a living, and I try to explain to them the importance of closing line value in betting and betting concepts. And it seems for a lot of people just to go in one ear and completely out the other. And a lot of people who are selling picks in this industry right now, it's mainly about wins and losses and how many units that they've won. And what originally drew me to you in the first place, and I probably took notice of your Twitter account maybe roughly 3 years ago, was you were the first person that I knew of that was tracking their closing line value in addition to their ROI, which is very rare in this space. But it's not something that is just intuitive to people, the importance of closing line value. Like, how did you come across that? Because again, as a recreational gambler, I find that, especially if you're talking 3 or 4 years ago, there's not a lot of great content available to you. Like, how did you learn that that was valuable?
I think it was in 2017, or let's say between the 2016 and 2017 seasons. And I owe a lot about what I've learned about betting to True Poker Joe. He's at True Poker Joe at Twitter, very sharp guy. And he wrote that book, Sharper. And that book was really my kickstart into really understanding sports betting. He has like 19 or 20 chapters where he goes through every technical aspect of sports betting, like explaining how sharp handicapping works, what we are really betting on, the importance of line value, the importance of every single point that you can beat the market against on NFL or NBA or whatever, Kelly criteria, really everything. And that was really, after reading that book, where I really understood, hey, I had a completely false view on sports betting all the time. I just thought that you could fire away on any number just because you like any side. For instance, in 2016, I wouldn't have cared one bit about whether I could bet the Packers -6 or -6.5. I would just say, hey, I like the Packers in that matchup, angle B, A, B, and C, but I don't care whether I can get -6 or -6.5. And after reading Sharper, which is really a high recommendation, I can recommend the book to every bettor that is just starting, because it really gives you a clue about all the technical aspects of sports betting. And True Poker Joe himself, he's not a, let's say, closing line value fanatic. He's also more on the side that you don't need closing line value if you have a consistent and reliable return on close. But after reading that book, you really grasp the importance of any given point, no matter what sports you're betting on. And that's really when I grasped the concept of closing line value.
That's really interesting. You mentioned it's hilarious whenever I hear it, and I didn't know this before, but getting into the NFL because of King of Queens, I think, is a pretty hilarious story. But you're obviously based in Germany, where, I mean, soccer, or for you, football, European football, is pretty massive. A lot of other sports played there. Have you ever considered modeling out or handicapping any other sports? Like, what is it about the NFL that you've stuck to that? And is there any consideration to moving on to other things?
Yeah, so I would say that it's an advantage and a disadvantage at the same time for me, because the advantage is that I can basically spend 360 days a year researching and thinking about the NFL. But the disadvantage is that I don't have any other sports where I could make any more money simply by volume. Let's say if I were betting college basketball with an edge, that would be pretty solid to earn more money. But I don't have that, and I can't really tell you why. It's just that other sports don't really interest me. Last year, I wanted to dig into college football. I think in 2018, I learned coding and programming in R, and I also was playing around with some NFL betting models, and I thought that I could maybe try to build a college football model and just see how it goes. But then the pandemic hit, and I realized that if you don't follow that sports closely, and you cannot really build any reliable model when there are so many COVID opt-outs, and you can't really differentiate between which injuries matter or which opt-outs matter, and so on. And then I just said, I'm not going to do it, and I haven't tried it since.
Yeah, I can completely understand that. I mean, there's so many teams, there's so many games, and I think when there's college and NFL overlapping, as someone who really specializes in NFL, the thought of doing college as well can be very overwhelming to some. I know lots of people focus on one or the other. I don't think that's very uncommon.
Yeah, so I know, especially with originating Summa, it's, you know, it's tough to grind out every single market. Like Rob mentioned, if they're on at the same time, it's tough. So it's cool that you only do one sport. I think, you know, you mentioned it's an upside and a downside. But it's exactly that, because now your focus is on originating and that's it. So on that, you mentioned, you know, you started with R, back in 2018, learning how to code. You obviously before that, you know, maybe it wasn't a financial model or things like that, but you're still looking at modeling the game. So my question for you is, from the time when you started betting, all the way up to now, and let's call it the prep for this preseason and this offseason, you know, what's changed in your betting model? And maybe walk us through kind of what you incorporate in now that gives you an edge on the NFL.
So I always love to deal with numbers and statistics. And I have also written my bachelor's and master's thesis on sales forecasting and optimizing forecasting models in the sales business. And so I always had that passion to work with numbers, look into numbers, try to figure out what is signal, what is noise. And that's also how I got started into NFL betting back in, let's say, 2011. I always was looking at numbers, and I was basically trying to figure out what is the true performance of any given team in the NFL? What is their true performance over the past couple of weeks? What was their schedule, and how were they performing against that said schedule? What were some circumstances that you have to consider? And then I was basically trying to figure out where the markets could overvalue or undervalue certain teams. So that was basically my starting point back in 2011. And that's basically the core concept. We are always trying to figure out which teams are overvalued and which teams are undervalued in the marketplace. Nowadays, you are dealing with a lot more data. You have EPA, you have DVOA, and also, I think my knowledge of the game is evolving. So there's every season I learn more about the sports. I learn more about what is signal, what is noise, where do I have to put more focus on, what is something that I can basically put aside and not think about it anymore. And that's basically, I would describe where I'm evolving over the years.
How much subjective analysis goes into what you do? Because it sounds like you come up with your number on the game, and you compare it to obviously what's being offered in the market, and you're going to bet where you have a difference. But, you know, 3 or 4 years ago when I was betting the NFL, I was betting purely numbers. And then there was the one season where the Cleveland Browns covered like two games against a spread where I bet them like a dozen times. And I'm like, I need to stop doing this to myself. There's probably something I'm missing with this team. And I started to incorporate a little bit more subjective analysis and even just using a lot more feel in betting the NFL, as weird as that sounds coming from a numbers guy. I'm curious as to your process. Obviously, you're working with a lot of data. You're trying to interpret that data as best as you possibly can. But how much of what you do is like the human element being incorporated into it and your process, you know, kind of not being solely reliant on just the number that you make of a game?
Actually, it's the major part. So I would probably say like at least 80% is completely subjective. Like I said, I've been trying to build models over the past 3 years, but I'm not a super coder, so my skills are limited. And I was only able to build, let's say, a team level NFL model for spreads. But even though those models that I've built returned a profit against the Pinnacle closing line when backtesting, I think that in 2021, you cannot be successful betting the NFL when you rely on a team level model. I just don't think that this is working anymore because all the data that you could possibly get is already in the market. And there's so much context that you have to understand when betting NFL, in my opinion, which makes it, in my opinion, impossible to incorporate everything into a team level model. I can give an example. 2019, the Chiefs were flooded with injuries. Patrick Mahomes had two injuries, the kneecap, the high ankle sprain that he re-aggravated against the Colts prior to halftime. Tyreek Hill was missing 5 games. Eric Fisher was out, I think, for like 7 or 8 games. Andrew Wiley was out. Sammy Watkins was banged up. And it was just not the same Chiefs team that we were expecting going to the season. So the question becomes, what do you do with that in-season data? Because that in-season data, when everyone is hurt, doesn't really reflect what this team is going to do when they are all healthy. So no matter what team level number or team level data you can incorporate into your model, it's not going to be right. It's simply going to be wrong. And I think you have that subjective element to correct what your team level model gives you. So I think that every team level model that you could build is probably flawed in many ways. And that way I have to incorporate all the subjective analysis that I can. And that might sound weird, but I would always trust my intuition more than any model that I could build. So on Monday morning, you could give me the schedule for the upcoming Sunday with a pen and the paper, and the numbers that I would just write down purely based on intuition would probably be better than any model that I could possibly build. So there's that. And also when it comes to the NFL, in my experience, in my opinion, we are dealing with different matchups, with 16 different matchups every week, and every matchup between team A and team B is different. So I think we are dealing with a lot of non-linearities, so to speak, because let's say I create a subjective power rating, which I do and which I use every Monday morning, and I might have a linear relationship between two teams. So let's say I make team A -2 against an average team and team B -0.05. So that would be -1.5 on a neutral field. But when I dig into the matchup and I find that maybe team A has a significant advantage in the trenches on both sides of the ball, they could still have that same number in my power rating. But for that specific matchup, I would make a subjective adjustment because that advantage in the trenches isn't reflected in that linear relationship from my power rating. So I have to make these subjective adjustments. Another example would be last season. I think it was a Saturday. Bills at Broncos, and the Broncos, they didn't have a single starting cornerback anymore. AJ Bury, Bryce Callahan, they were on IR, I guess, And the Broncos are basically playing with practice squad cornerbacks against the Bills. So I already downgraded the Broncos in my power rating for their cornerbacks being out. But now they were playing against an elite passing attack that loves to run all those four wide receiver sets, and Brian Daboll calling the highest passing rate on neutral downs in the league. So that's a matchup advantage that's not linear anymore. It's in my opinion, a non-linear effect that we have to deal with, because that matchup is basically, I don't know how the Bills are going to punt in that game. So maybe my power rating said to make the Bills -6.5 that game, but I was probably coming up with, I don't know, -7.5 or something. So that's basically all that goes into it. My approach, I like to use a team level model as a supporting tool, but most of my work is in the subjective department.
I remember that Bills game almost like it was yesterday, because I felt like I was on a lonely island with the Bills and couldn't understand why everyone loved the Broncos in that game, other than 85% of the public is betting Buffalo type of situation, which we've dismissed on a earlier episode of Circles Off. But I that was one of those games where I felt like I handicapped it correctly, pat myself on the back, which was nice. Suma, a couple weeks ago, I think late July, we had Eddie Walls on here, who takes a very similar approach to you, but in college football. And he talked about no one's going to outwork him type of I think that was a quote from him exactly. Like, my edge is the amount of time I put in. No one's going to outwork me in college football. I know that. You know, I start my year 15 days after the college football season ends. I'm curious what your year looks like, essentially. So the Super Bowl ends. Tampa Bay beats Kansas City last year. How soon are you looking at the next season and starting to get into the, you know, getting your team power ratings together, potentially looking at which players can move all over the place? How quickly does that become a thing for you?
Basically, one day after the Super Bowl, which sounds crazy, but to be honest, from the Super Bowl until the NFL draft, I don't spend as much time on football. I try to go to bed way earlier than during the season and enjoy some free time. But for example, I have a Slack group with some German football nerds. Also a few guys that work on football full time in any capacity as a journalist or whatever. And after the Super Bowl, we already talk about the next season, about the draft and about some off-season changes, whatever. And then, mid-March, free agency starts, and after free agency, I try to compile my power rating, basically doing an initial rating where I think every team stands. Also, already having done some, let's say, review work where I go through last season, look at data, look at numbers, look at which teams had overperformed, which teams had terrible injury luck, all that kind of stuff. And right after free agency, I basically start putting together my rating. And from that on, there's going to be the NFL draft. And right after the draft, probably in May, I start to dig into every team, basically spending several hours a day digging into one team each at a time. Studying the depth chart, looking what I could be missing from last season, where teams have changed, et cetera, and I also write down a preview on every team that I post into my Slack channel. And I think writing down a team preview also helps me articulating my thoughts, or all my thoughts that I have in my mind, and basically helps me even understanding some teams better, because let's say I want to write about the offensive line of the Falcons, and I want to write about rookie center Drew Delman, who had some very good scouting reports and could execute that outside zone scheme from Arthur Smith. That's something I have to dig in, and writing these previews really helped me to dig a little bit deeper than I would probably usually do.
For those players in particular, like rookies coming up, I'm assuming you're leaning on a lot of the other content that's been published in the space. And that's the main thing I've noticed, the biggest difference I've noticed over the course of the past 10 years. I used to write content for the NFL. I used to write a 5,000 word article every single week that would literally take me an entire day to write. And I would have to prep for it beforehand. But the emergence of content has been like exponential, I guess would be the word I would use over the last few years or so, where you just have so much different stuff in the space. It's not just fantasy advice anymore. There's a lot more centered around betting, but there's the emergence of sites like PFF, where you look at PFF's site 5 years ago to where it is now, and it's night and day, and there's a lot of others in the space. How closely do you pay attention to these other sites in the space? Is there stuff that you religiously use? Is there stuff that you avoid? I'm just curious as to what other content you're paying attention to.
Yeah, so there are several sites and content that I use. First of all, I'm a big podcast guy. So every time I drive in my car or I work out, I'm basically listening to any kind of podcast, whether it's the PFF Forecast from George Shahuri and Eric Eager, the PFF NFL show, the Athletic Football Show from Robert Mays, or some fantasy stuff. All that kind of stuff is really interesting and helps you find some little information pieces that you wouldn't find otherwise. I use Pro Football Focus religiously. I think their grading system is not perfect, and there are always some flaws that you have to know. But overall, I think it's basically the best grading information that you could possibly get, because even though we watch a lot of football, it's impossible to get a clue about the performance level of all 22 players on a field. So PFF really helps me to, I don't want to know whether Jalen Ramsey has a 74 or 89 grade, but I want to know whether the third cornerback on the Falcons is a scrub or has some potential based on his rookie season, for example. So that's the kind of stuff I want to know. So PFF religiously in June, or I think it was July, the Football Outsiders Almanac comes out every year. So that's something where I read all 32 team chapters and make some notes. And you always find some information nugget that you could really use when it comes to the NFL season. The Athletic is a great resource where you have all those beat writers consistently writing stories about their teams. Establish the One from Evan Silva and Adam Levitan. I mean, I'm not a big fantasy guy. I play like in some home leagues, some dynasty and some baseball leagues, but they have some very good content on their site that you could also, that you can also use for sports betting. And that's basically the main stuff that I'm focusing on, and always Twitter. Twitter is the best resource. There are so many film guys posting all their content where they study some players and teams and post clips online, and all those beat writers digging into their team. So I would describe those as the main resources.
Yeah, got it. That's interesting. I agree completely. Twitter is an unbelievable resource. But it's good to, you know, I've never heard that angle before. So it's like you're saying, you know, even the gradings aren't even though they're not perfect, they're good enough in certain levels of things. I think, you know, anyone listening might be able to relate that to other sports as well, right? It does, like Suma mentioned, doesn't matter if it's perfect, as long as it's better than what's available, you can still find value and potentially still find an edge. So obviously you watch a lot of football, Suma. I know myself and Rob do as well. I'm up early every Sunday. I'm getting fired up. I got the 3-screen setup going with the fourth on the side. I tilt the mountain on the fourth screen, put all the cable boxes, and then it's just a fiasco at 1 o'clock. But I know it's, you know, right now we're recording this late afternoon. I know it's pretty late for you there. With the time difference, first off, but second off, how is your football, you know, routine? What goes into it, and, you know, what time is it?
So right now it's 10:30 in the evening. I am 6 hours ahead of the East Coast. So when the 1 p.m. game start, it's 7 p.m. In the evening for me.
So you got 9 primetime games sometimes. Love
basically,
that.
Basically, yeah. So usually on Sunday, I start watching games at 7 p.m. my time. And I watch until the Sunday night game, where I at some point fall asleep. And that's basically 3 a.m. in the morning for me, somewhere around that. And then my son wakes me up around like 7 or something like that. And then I grab 3, 4, 5 coffees and an energy. And then I start grinding the schedule of the upcoming week. And sometimes I work until the night or late in the evening. And when it comes to those night games, let's say I have a bet on Thursday night football, I'm automatically going to watch it. And then I would go to bed like at 11 in the evening, set an alarm for 2:10 or 2:15 in the morning and watch the game. And I think the downside from September to January is that I'm tired all the week. But in the end, there's nothing that coffee can fix.
How does the wife deal with that, Suma?
That's actually not a big issue. I think the only thing that's not nice is that sometimes I have to work until late in the night. Because when it's 4 p.m. in the afternoon, NFL practices kick off and the information flow goes until like 11 or midnight my time. So I have to stay awake and try to get all the information ready. That's sometimes, let's say, not very great, but all the other stuff, watching games at night, she doesn't really care about. And even though I'm a little bit tired on weekdays, that's also not an issue.
Yeah, got it. So here's what I want to know. It's a bit of a stupid question. When you wake up at 2 in the morning or 2:30 in the morning, I know if I've ever had to do that, I just fall back right back asleep. Now, there's probably few things that I would wake up for. I mean, I'll tell a quick story here. Actually, my fantasy football league, one league. We take it very, very seriously. Wherever you can get an edge, you get it. And in our league, what happens is that we play on ESPN, and ESPN removes the waivers where you can claim a guy through waivers and puts all those players into free agency at precisely 3:43 a.m. And recently they moved it and now it's variable, which is a big mess. But for years, there'd be at least like 8 of the 12 members of my league. If you were looking to claim a guy on free agency without burning your waiver order, you'd wake up at 3:30 in the morning. You'd refresh your phone or your computer for 4 minutes until that happened, and then you'd pick up a guy. And then right after that, I'd go directly back to bed, and there was no hope of me staying up for 4 hours. So I wanted to ask you, when you wake up at 2:30, how do you get fired up for the game? Like, so it's probably crushing a coffee. Do you grab food? Like, you watch the game downstairs while the wife's upstairs? Like, what happens?
To be honest, when I wake up and I know I have a stake on the game and my pulse is probably at 100 already. And usually I just grab my iPad and watch the game from my bed. And that's pretty much it. So if I have a stake on the game, so to be honest, if I didn't bet a Thursday night football game, I wouldn't get up in the night. So I would just watch it in the morning, check the score, watch it on Game Pass, the 40 version, and that's it. But if I have a stake on the game and if I bet a game, I can get up at 2:15 in the morning and I'm 100% awake.
So you're just a lover of betting. You're just a passionate for the game, for the love of the game, basically.
Yeah.
Commitment to the craft. I mean, Johnny is the type of guy where I book an 8 a.m. tee time for us, and this guy is like rolling his eyes like, I can't be up that, or shows up to the course like 4 minutes after I've already teed off. Looks like he slept for like 3 hours. So maybe he's not the right guy to wake up in the middle of the night and stay awake, but yeah, that's that happened pretty recently, actually. All right, Suma, I have to get into it. This is Circles Off. We ask the hard questions here. We don't just bring on our friends and pump their egos or anything like that. I mentioned it earlier. You run a subscription service. People would call you a tout in the space, and I think by definition, you are. There was a flowchart that circulates through Twitter that was made famous by someone named Sprager back in the day as to why you should never buy picks from a tout. And I think anyone who looks at your public records and sees the 4 seasons you've had publicly would say, if you're winning at this rate, then why are you touting?
Yeah, good question. I think the simplest answer would be money. but there are some more nuances to it. And I want to really get into it because that's a question that I got a lot in the past, over the past 4 years. So first of all, what people have to know is that in Germany, when you are an employee, you get a monthly salary and you automatically pay income taxes, health insurance, and into the public retirement fund. When you are self-employed, you don't have the benefits. You can't pay into the retirement fund. You have to take care of health insurance yourself, which is a lot more expensive than if you were an employee. But in Germany, if you are self-employed and you do something like art or music or journalism, you get the same benefits as every employee in Germany, where you can just pay your taxes, your health insurance, which is pretty cheap that way, and you can pay into the public retirement fund just because you're doing a job like a musician, doing arts or journalism or whatever. And yes, I sell pics, but I also produce a lot of content around that. So I have a lot of written analysis. For example, if you sign up right now, you have access to my 77-page team preview for the season where I broke down all 32 teams. During the regular season, I give out a written analysis on all my official picks. And I also upload a podcast every week where I break down the entire card. And that way, I fall into the category of journalism in Germany. So that's basically my public job where I pay taxes, health insurance, and into the public retirement fund. So that's basically my steady income, which I can rely on. And now to the question why I do it if I could win money betting NFL. I only bet NFL. I bet, or let's say I place 130 bets a year on sites and totals, maybe some draft props, maybe some team totals. And everyone can do the math in their head right now, everyone who's listening. Let's say my yearly average was 12 units of profit in the NFL. So everyone can now do the math in his head. What would my unit size have to be if I would make, or if I wanted to make a living simply betting the NFL? What would my unit size be on 12 units return? And then you can calculate what your theoretical bankroll has to be to make a living from 12 units. And that's not a lot of volume. And I'm not a big bettor, to be completely honest with you. And let's say I have a below average year and I win 6 units. Let's say, I don't know, 4 or 5% ROI, 6 units, which would be a solid outcome in general. So I would have to deal with negative variance where I cannot rely on my winnings, or let's say on my average winnings from an NFL season. But almost every subscriber would still make money and would probably still find value in my season-long analysis and breakdowns on all the games. So it's a win-win situation. So why in the world should I not sell picks? Would be my counter-argument.
So yeah, I understand that. And I think it's a rational argument that you put together. I will say, when I first took note of you 3 years ago, you can correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I am, but I believe that your releases were not moving the market. Whereas I think now, especially last year, anytime you did post a play to your Slack channel, within 5 minutes, the market was, I don't want to say it was gone. It's not like somebody was, you know, the number was completely taken out, moved from -3 to -6, but you would definitely see that there was a tick at pretty much every outlet possible. Is there any concern on your end that possibly the subscribers are not able to get down at the numbers that you release? Has that been something that has ever been echoed to you from people who subscribe to your service?
Yes, absolutely. I think about that every time, especially early in the season, or when you release picks early in the week on Mondays or Tuesday, it could get really ugly for people who are, let's say, 5 minutes late. But I will say that it's impossible for every subscriber to get the same price as what my release is. It's just impossible. It's just not going to happen that you can get every pick at the same price. As soon as you are 2 minutes late, the actual price is probably gone. I know that, and we talk about that in the Slack channel, sometimes guys are able to pick up some stale numbers at local books where they even get a better price than what my release was. But if you are betting entirely offshore, or you're betting at some skins that are well connected to Chris or Pinnacle lines, it's basically impossible to get the same number if you are a few minutes too late. To be honest, I had like 3 or 4 complaints last year. So I don't think that's a big issue for subscribers in general. And I will also say, even though people will not be able to get the same line as I do, let's say I had like 2% closing line value on NFL sites in totals last year, the average subscriber will probably still get, let's say, 1.5% of closing line value. And we're also pretty good in the category of return close, which our friend Plus EV Analytics had a phenomenal article a few weeks ago where he differentiated between the guys who try to beat the closing line, between the guys who just focus on return on close. So I think overall, even though people will not be able to, on average, get the same price as I release, I think they still find a lot of value in that subscription service.
That article he wrote was a lot better than his golf game, because me and Johnny played with him that weekend, and he was struggling out there, as Joe Namath would have said. Suma, so like I have that tout chart I was referring to earlier up in front of me, right? I guess maybe this is me doing some of your defense for you, but I respect what you do. I've worked with you now in doing some content, and we talk pretty regularly. But where this chart breaks down for me, and this is one of the arguments that I've always had, is you get to a point where it says, do the lines move when he bets them? Yes or no? So we're going to take the path of yes for you. And it says, to the extent that there was ever any value in the picks, it's gone by the time you bet. You're getting minus EV leftovers while this asshole front runner is getting the good stuff. Fuck him. Don't give him a penny. Whereas my argument to this is that, and I've seen the closing line value on your plays just in general, it is possible that they're getting worse numbers. That doesn't mean that they're minus EV. And I think that's where this argument falls short. And it's the same for the people who complain about right angle sports in general, where if you look at how far some of those numbers move, okay, yeah, you're not getting this exact same number at release in some cases, but you're still getting a number that is vastly beating the closing line. And one more thing I will say, and why I really respect what you do, whether you know some people don't like the touting or not, is that your plays are graded against Pinnacle and Chris, which are the two sharpest sports books out there that are taking big bets. And what I found last year is oftentimes you'd find, I'd say more often than not, you're able to find a number on an existing offshore in a regulated market that is better than the number that you're giving out. And that happened quite frequently. So, I don't know. This is not a question. I just wanted to get it out there, because I think that's kind of where this like tout flow chart breaks down just in general. But yeah, I understand the concerns people might have with all the line movement that's there, but I think it's just very difficult, to argue against consistent results. And even if somebody was getting a worse number, we can easily calculate what that comes out to. And I think it's still a pretty hell of a good return for subscribers. So go ahead, Johnny.
Yeah, I was just going to ask Suma. So like you're selling picks, obviously. We wouldn't have you on if you were a quote unquote scumbag tout. You wouldn't be a friend of Rob's. You wouldn't be a friend of ours. I will say you are exhibiting all of the things of what we would call responsible touting, in a sense that there's no picks being deleted. You're not past posting. You're transparent on when the releases are going to happen and at what numbers they're going to be at. Always grading against, at the time of release, a Pinnacle or a Chris number, which, as Rob mentioned, if you take a look at BetStamp right now and just sort for week one lines and put Pinnacle and Chris in there, you're going to see that Pinnacle or Chris is going to be, not the best line for almost every single game across the book. So to Rob's point, even if you are posting against Pinnacle and Chris, if you're beating those lines, that means you're going to be able to beat almost every line in the game, given that those other lines, you know, if you're picking off a few of the regulated books or a few offshores, are going to be much softer. So I'd say you're doing all the right things. And like I mentioned, we wouldn't have you on if we didn't believe that as well. But the question is, if you are having success in the game right now as a bettor, at what point will you ever stop touting and kind of remove the stigma of maybe being grouped in with some of the more quote unquote scumbag touts in the game?
Yes, there could definitely be a scenario in which I would stop selling picks. I love to produce content on the NFL, whether it's written on podcasts or on video. And if at some point someone approached me and offered me a good deal, let's say a good financial deal where I needed to stop selling picks or selling that content and produced that same content on a different audience without all the paywalls and basically not letting others pay for the picks, I would probably do that. I had no issue stopping that, but at the same time, right now it also makes a lot of fun. But if someone came across and said, hey, we are offering you that same amount of money that you are making from subscriptions for doing, let's say, some public content or whatever, I would probably at least think about it.
Interesting that you mentioned that, because I think a lot of people in the, I don't want to say a lot of people, but there are people in this space, including myself, that got recognized based off of lines moving whenever they post something, just a track record of having some positive impact or on the market or whatever. And as far as I'm aware, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, you're mainly working alone. I mean, I haven't heard you mention a partner or working as part of a larger operation. Have you been approached by others to partner up? And if so, you know, why continue to work alone?
I'm not working alone anymore. I got approached for the first time before the 2019 season. That was kind of a larger group that offered me a free roll if I basically sent them my plays pre-release and give them some other insights from my work. But that was not really a smooth process. We only worked together like 7 or 8 weeks into the season, and then it suddenly stopped. I didn't see a single penny from that collaboration.
Oh, welcome to the industry, Sumba.
Yes, exactly. Then basically the approaches started getting more frequently, guys who want to free roll me for pre-releases. And I started to work together with some guys. Some guys were really good, smooth process, everything went well. I got paid at the end of the season. Some others didn't really want to pay after the season. And right now...
Name, Sumo. We need to name names here.
I don't want to put a name, but I think a certain share of the audience can maybe spot that person. Mm. But I don't want to talk badly about anyone on a podcast if he can't defend himself. So we'll leave it at this. But right now I'm working together, let's say, with a group where I'm pretty excited about, which makes a lot of fun, where we pretty basically bet my stuff or bet my picks before the release without moving the market. And then I go on and release that to my subscribers.
Interesting, Sumba. It's been great chatting with you and talking to you about your process in general. Funny enough, I don't think I've actually ever shared this with you. I think I've shared this with Johnny before, but the first time I ever heard you speak, I don't remember which podcast it was, but I remember you pronounced Pinnacle as Pinnacle. And I was in my head, I was thinking, like, who is this clown? What am I listening to? And it's funny that years later, we're actually friends, but I do remember that pretty vividly and had a good laugh over that one.
Yeah, I think it was on the deep dive with Andy and Drew.
Was it? Okay. Yeah, Pinnacle. I'll never forget that one. And we all have things that will never live down. And obviously, actually, you know what? This is a question for you. Like, do you learn English in German school growing up? Because you actually speak pretty fluent English.
Yes, we start learning it in, I think, fifth grade. And until you finish high school. So you pretty much learn it for 7 or 8 years. I was always a very lazy student, so I didn't really care about it. And I had no interest in talking English in poems or something like that, or reading some of those stupid books in school. And at some point, when I started digging more into US sports and football, I just started reading English basically for several hours every day. I started talking to lots of Americans and Canadians, for example, and I've reached a point where I'm thinking in English when I think about football, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so I understand that. Yeah.
Every time I think about football, I basically think in my head or talk to myself in English, but I don't think that I could talk fluently about any other topics like politics or something like that.
I mean, it's pretty impressive regardless. I mean, Johnny, knows we're in Canada and we live in a multilingual country where we had to take French in school from grade one all the way through high school. And I can't speak a lick of French right now. Like if I had, I mean, a little bit I could maybe to get by. And I've been to Montreal a few times. Luckily, they speak English more than French over there. But no, I mean, it's pretty impressive to be able to get to that level. Even just learning in school, but you know, not practicing it on a daily basis, I guess.
I think that's the hardest part. You just learn all those words in school, and then you suddenly have to talk about some stupid books or poems or stuff like that, and not really the meaningful topics in life, so to speak.
Yeah, it's tough to learn something if you're not using it on a day-to-day basis, because you only have a limited amount of time in the day. So, you know, to learn French when I don't need to learn it and I have no passion to do it, you know, how am I going to be motivated to do that? We're at the other end with Suma here, you know, all these articles, Pro Football Focus, I don't know, but like, listen, maybe you can translate it and is what it is with an online translator, but they don't publish a lot of German content as far as last time I checked. So, you know, if you want to be watching these videos, you know, on Twitter, following beat reporters, that you have to learn English. So I think that's kind of where the necessity stems from. But yeah, your English has, you know, come a long way even in the last couple of years. But good for you. I wanted to give you a chance to promote, you know, the picks that you're selling. Thanks for coming on the podcast. We want to give you the platform. Where do you sell your picks? Where can people get them? Floor is yours.
Yeah, so you can approach me on Twitter at SUUMA. 810. I have a website, football-handicapping.com. It's basically just a landing page where you can sign up. And after signing up, you get a link to my Slack channel where I will add you. And that's where I post all my picks and analysis. And we have great discussions during the season with the community. I really enjoy that. And I also sell my picks on Betstamp. Shameless plug.
That was what I was hoping for. That was what I was hoping for when I gave you the floor.
And we take no commission. You get all of the sales, Suma.
That's true. That's true.
And that's not just for Suma, for the record. It's for everybody. But go ahead.
Yes. There you can basically buy a monthly or yearly package directly in the app. I think it's at Fabian Sommer. It's basically my first and second name, at first name, second name. And that's my profile. I think I started tracking all my bets on Betstamp, I think in week 9 last season. And I will continue, automatically have to track every bet there because I'm selling my picks there. And I will also use that platform for all my tracking going forward, because I'm on the Betstamp podcast, but I'm completely honest, it's a great app.
We appreciate that.
Yeah, we approached Suma last year to sell on the platform in addition. And I think one thing that speaks volume to anybody who is selling picks as well is if they are willing to be transparent about it. There is always going to be people selling picks. Whether you want to buy something from Suma or not is your choice. But at the end of the day, I think everyone owes respect to Suma and anybody else who, you know, like Ed from Right Angle Sports as well, who is willing to be transparent about the picks he's releasing. So Sumo, we thank you for posting on Betstamp. I know you're posting on at the same time as the release. So anyone who is purchasing on Betstamp is getting a direct notification in the app as well at the same time of release. And they've got, you know, that couple minute window at the minimum before, you know, everything starts to evaporate. So we appreciate you posting on Betstamp. Anyone who wants to buy them, you can one click direct in the app and all that money is going direct to Sumo.
I just checked out FabianSomer.com just to see what was up. Some like kids clothing site. I don't know. That was a big miss, Sumo. You should have secured that domain, man. That thing's going to blow up. As your following blows up, people are visiting this kid's clothing site. It's pretty weird. But yeah. Anyway, Sumo.
Not from me.
No. No, I mean, it's a well-made site, I will say that. But anyways, that's going to get like five times the traffic this week, and they're going to wonder why. All right, Sumo, let's end with this. If you could go back 5 years and talk to a previous version of yourself, what piece of advice would you give to your former self?
I would probably tell my old self to promote 500 unit whale plays on Twitter because it's probably a great selling strategy. No, jokes aside, I would probably tell my old self to dig more into props in general, because I think even though you can't get down as much, it's there are some pretty solid markets to beat. And I would tell myself to focus more on networking, because I think networking in this industry is everything. Whether you want to try to get more down, you want to try to get more down at some different places where you don't have access to, or just the optimization of information flow. Just working together with some guys during the season on a daily basis is so impactful. And that's pretty much what I would tell my old self.
That's actually a piece of advice that we haven't heard yet with the closing question. And I mean, we're living that in real life this week. Me and Johnny are headed to New Jersey for Bet Bash, and like I don't want to hang out with Spanky for 4 or 5 hours. I'm there to network with other people, you know. And I mean, I owe a lot of what I have today to building relationships through people in person, and I think there's and over the internet, I should say. And I think that's a very interesting piece of advice that often goes overlooked. So, thanks for joining us today, Sumo. All the best during NFL season. Hopefully, I mean, you have to live up to that 7.5% ROI this year. There's a lot of pressure. I don't know if you're feeling it going into the year, but yeah.
Sumo, thank you for coming on the podcast. We look forward to, you know, a good NFL season and wish you best of luck.
Thank you guys very much for having me on. And I had a blast talking to you, and I also wish you lots of success going forward, not only in the NFL and NHL seasons and in the prop markets, but also with Betstamp.
Thanks. Much appreciated. Please rate and review 5 stars. This has been episode 22 of Circles Off.